Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, has developed a 130-foot boat that can prowl the seas unmanned, a kind of 21st century ghost ship. Military officials think it can be effective in detecting submarines. For an assessment of whether this is where we're headed, we turn to Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Brian, good to have you back.
Great to be on. Thanks, Tom.
This ship, it's a boat because it doesn't have a boat on it, right? So that means it's not a ship.
Right. It's a ship, and it's an unmanned ship.
It is a ship.
Right. So it's a ship, and it's about 130 feet long, like you were saying. And it looks, it's very futuristic looking. It's a catamaran, so you've got a narrow hull, and then you've got two outriggers that come out of it. And it's made out of a combination of composite material and steel. But it's big. So it's as big as, it looks kind of like a yacht, maybe, if you were to make a really fancy yacht and make it futuristic looking.
Just no windows.
No windows, right? There's a little bridge that they put on it so people can be on it for testing, but they'll take that off as soon as the testing's complete.
And how is it powered?
So it's powered by diesel engines. It's, got a pretty traditional power plant and a pretty traditional control system, just, like you would have on any other ship. What DARPA was trying to do here is focus their attention with the new technologies for the autonomy of the vessel. So they try to keep everything else as low-tech as possible in order to reduce the risk associated with the non-autonomy aspects of the ship.
So when you say autonomy, that means someone is not controlling it with a joystick, but it has a pre-programmed route. And what does it do, navigate by GPS?
Right. So even more so than that, what it'll do is have a pre-planned set of missions it has to do with locations in which those missions have to be done. And then the vessel itself will choose its route in order to get there. And so it'll use GPS to determine where it is in the world and where it is relative to where it has to go. But instead of a pre-planned route that you would program in, like you were programming your drone, the hobby drone, this thing will actually determine where it needs to go. It'll evaluate the traffic that's out there, steer around traffic, stay out of shipping lanes, or stay in shipping lanes until it needs to depart from those shipping lanes. So it's smart enough to be able to build its own plan for how it's going to go about doing the mission.
And it must take into account weather and so forth?
Right. So it has to be told, what some of the weather concerns might be, so it can steer around those or at least take a good course in those weather conditions.
And who built it for DARPA?
So there was a shipyard out in Portland who actually built the ship, and then DARPA is working with a number of companies, Leidos being one of them, to build the autonomy systems for it. So Leidos, I believe, is the overall prime contractor for the ship, and then the shipyard in Portland actually built the hull.
All right, so this is the first surface vessel, then, that is autonomous. I guess they have some undersea drones that have been worked on also.
Right. The Navy does have a few unmanned surface vessels, but they're small. They're like the size of a little, a small pleasure boat, 15 to 30 meters long or 15 to 30 feet long, rather. And those are used for scouting, and they're used for mine warfare missions where they'll drag mine warfare gear behind them. So they're relatively small. This is the first large autonomous ship that the DOD's built.
So the small things are more like robotics versus this, which is where you can go the seven seas out of sight of anybody.
Very good point. Yeah. So the smaller vessels are really something you'd control kind of like with a joystick, whereas this thing is going to go be able to steer itself to a location.
And so earlier I mentioned the possibility of using it for submarine chasing, but is that what the Navy thinks it's the best use for?
Not necessarily. So originally DARPA had envisioned this as being a vessel that could go out, use a passive sonar to find the general area in which an enemy submarine might be operating, and then get close to it and then use an active sonar to start pinging on it, just like you see in the World War II movies. And once they've tracked the submarine, follow it around for the duration of its deployment or until if somebody wants to attack it, we would then bring in something to attack it. The problem the Navy has with that is in peacetime, that's a very provocative thing to do, is to be pinging away at somebody else's submarine with a vessel that's following it on the surface. And then in wartime, it'd be somewhat vulnerable to attack by the enemy, because now you've got this 130-foot ship that's driving around on the surface following their own submarine.
All right. So if that one is out, although maybe Russia would do it since they buzz our ships with aircraft. Maybe they would buzz our submarines with something unmanned. What could it be used for?
So once you've got a vessel of that size that's able to operate autonomously for a long period of time, you could use it for a lot of things. So one mission that the Navy might look at is for decoying carrier strike groups. So if you have an aircraft carrier driving around, the concern is it's a very detectable target as lots of radars and lots of things that are emitting off of it. You could put decoy systems on this ship and have it be your simulated carrier so it could attract the attention of somebody's surveillance systems or their missiles.
We're speaking with Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And what do you think the Navy brass feels about something like this, where it's a ship or a boat or whatever, it is a large vessel that is unmanned? There's no captaincy associated with it.
Right. So I think they're very excited about the idea of having something that's large, unmanned, and autonomous. They could go out for a long period of time and take some of the pressure off of the manned ships, because the Navy's fleet has been shrinking over the last 30 years or so. Some of the missions that Navy ships are expected to do are simply surveillance missions, where you're going to go, listen in on somebody else's electronic communications, or you're towing a sonar array to go monitor their submarines. Well, this ship that DARPA's built could do some of those missions and take the pressure off the manned fleet. So they're excited about that idea. And then in terms of the autonomy being out of the control of a person, I think the Navy's intent is not to put weapons on this kind of system. So the ship would be driving around and it'd be under the control of some commander who would give it tasking but not tell it exactly where to go.
But there must be some override capability, because I guess how closely can it maneuver, say, in a port or among a crowded area with lots of vessels?
It's very good at that. So that what they've used in this system and in some of the other unmanned ships is the same systems that the Mars rover uses to be able to maneuver itself around and avoid running into things that are out there. And then also they've got programmed into it the rules of the road for ocean-going vessels. So it's like programming your unmanned driverless car to be able to operate the streets alongside manned cars.
And if they decided to weaponize it, is there any plan to, if they put a 57-millimeter gun, say, on it,
right,
that can do a lot of damage close up or even not so close up. But is there any operational concept for how that might work?
So what the Navy's not thinking of arming this thing yet, but the first way to do it would be to have it just be the remote-controlled carrier of weapons that somebody else is directing. So you could have it carry missiles that you tell the ship where to launch the missile to, and then the missile's largely autonomous on its own. So the ship's not deciding when to launch, but a person is telling the ship to launch. So that's probably the first generation of how this would be done.
And that alone is a step beyond the current missile ships that they're dealt with, very small crews, lots of missiles.
Right.
But those are already afloat. So this is a step beyond that.
Right, exactly. So this would be, another magazine of missiles available to a manned ship to use when they run out of their own missiles, for example.
Okay, and then you said beyond that, there's even more thoughts.
So what you could, one thing that some of the people working in this field are looking at is could I have the vessel make its own determination with regard to a target that it has to engage? So this would be the example of if you took a Predator drone that today we use a joystick and steer it and then tell it when to launch. You would instead say, look for a target that looks like this, and you can attack it when the time comes to do so. What a lot of people are working autonomy right now are figuring out is, how do I do the automatic target recognition to be able to determine that that's really the enemy and it's the exact kind of enemy target that I was told to attack?
So this gets to be interesting, because you have unmanned or autonomous vehicles in the air and afloat that could kill people and armies and navies. And so you have unmanned drones and autonomous vehicles looking for other drones and autonomous.
Right.
And so they shoot each other.
Right.
Question is, how do you know when you've won?
Right.
This changes war doctrine a lot.
It does. And so it makes attrition warfare maybe more likely in the future, where the goal is to take out as many of the other guy's drones as possible.
All right. So it becomes kind of a chess match in some ways,
right,
without human blood, at least in the initial stages.
Right. You start to manage your drone force, your unmanned force, to a much greater degree than you are directly fighting your own.
All right, we'll have to see how that one develops. Brian Clark is senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tom.
Read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Some virtual reality training requires goggles. Some requires big banks of screens. Now the Army is experimenting with a dome-shaped immersive environment. Joining me with more on this development, Dr. Carolyn Mahoney, team leader for the Cognitive Science and Applications team from the Army Natick Soldier Research, Development, and Engineering Center. Dr. Mahoney, great to have you on.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on.
So tell us about the dome. What is it? Is it bigger than a bread box? And what happens in there?
Sure, absolutely. The dome is about 3 meters big. So if you can visualize that, standing inside the dome, it's about 14 feet high and about 11 and a half feet deep. And when you're inside the dome, you have a 180-degree horizontal field of view. So it really feels like you're inside your world. In addition, that also has full audio surround sound as well.
So 180 degrees is a little bit more than your full peripheral vision.
Yes, it is. And so it allows some movement and some turning within your world. And the dome relies on a high-density front projection system. So by using these projectors, we create a really high-resolution, seamless world across this 180 degrees.
So it's almost as if you were in a planetarium, only it dropped down on your head.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what it feels like.
And so the people that would be using this would be standing in it, not seated, though, because it's taller than you say it's 14 feet tall.
Yes. No, they're standing within this dome.
And so by projecting the picture on a semicircle or a semi-half dome, I guess, they could also look up and down a little bit and still be immersed.
Yes, they can look up and down and side to side to some degree. It does not cover completely over their head.
And what do you envision this being used for?
So we use this dome primarily for research. So the mission of our team is to really understand soldier cognitive capabilities and limitations within sort of the unique environments that they operate in. And then we take this information that we use and we use it to inform sort of the next generation design, development, and testing for new technologies. So some of the things we do within this dome are our research. We're interested in if soldiers are performing particular tasks under stress, under time pressure, you know, how does that affect, you know, their cognitive workload? So how hard they're working mentally. And then we're also interested in looking at if the Army is designing new technologies, how might those technologies impact performance while they're doing real mission-related tasks.
And so try to bring this into reality. A soldier standing in a dome, what is he or she looking at, and what might they be doing simultaneously?
So when they're standing in the dome, this dome is actually quite unique because the environments in which these participants are looking at are actually real-world environments. They're modeled after existing places, the satellite imagery of existing places. So you have accurate sort of topography and sort of environmental features for that actual location in the world.
It's not like a video game, which is created in a visual studio.
No, it has sort of a mixed sense of reality with a little bit of a video game look to it.
Okay, so what type of scene would be projected then? Just static scenery, or would be something kinetic happening?
No, absolutely not static. So within this dome, individuals are able to move through immersive scripted scenarios, and we can track their location as they're moving, the orientation of their body, of their head. We can track their eyes, where they're looking, and they're able to interact with this environment. They can impart change upon the environment through handheld and weapon-based input devices. So they can walk, they can look around, they can aim and fire weapons within the environment as well, and we can track their accuracy on shooting tasks, marksmanship tasks within that environment.
Explain just a little bit more closely how they can walk, because if it's 11 feet across, if they walk 5.5 feet, their nose will bump into the dome.
Right. So right now, the way they move through the environment is actually through a button or joystick control, which is placed on their weapon. So they have a mock weapon in this environment, and buttons on that allow them to move forward and backward and side to side in the environment. We are currently working on having something called redirected walking in the environment. So essentially, they will have sensors on their body which will track, you know, how quickly they are moving their feet. They'll be walking in place, essentially.
And so you could put maybe a treadmill in there.
We could put a treadmill in there, but one of the issues with that is sort of having exact accuracy between how the treadmill is moving and the environment is moving. And sometimes with a treadmill, you tend to get more motion sickness. So this redirected walking and having them physically moving their legs in place, it takes away a little bit of that motion and sickness piece.
We're speaking with Dr. Carolyn Mahoney. She's team leader for the Cognitive Science and Applications team up at the Natick Army Research Labs. And so in the environment that they're looking at, are there things happening? Are there like snarling Taliban popping out behind rocks and that sort of thing?
Yes. So depending on the scenario that we are placing individuals in, as they are walking through their environment, there is realistic scenery, trees, grass. There could be huts, buildings. There are people in the environment. There could be, you know, animals, things like that. There could be vehicles, UAVs. It really depends on the scenario that we put them in, but it's a very interactive environment.
So it tests reaction and the ability to think straight when there are distractions or maybe dangers coming at the soldier.
Absolutely. So a lot of what we're interested in is looking at how either particular scenarios or tasks that have to be done in these scenarios or particular pieces of technology affect things like your ability to respond quickly, your ability to make a decision both quickly and also the correct decision, your ability to potentially withhold an action. You know, so for an example, a decision to shoot or don't shoot. So those types of things we're looking at. And we measure these sort of multiple ways. We measure them through things like firing the weapon, aiming and firing the weapon, so we get a response, an active response in the environment. We also measure these things through physiology and neurophysiology. So in this dome, we can have participants suited up so that we can measure things like the electrical activity in their brain through an EEG cap. We can measure where they are looking in the environment. We can measure how their pupil is changing. We can measure things like heart rate, skin response, and these things tell us sort of what's happening physiologically, and they tell us things about the soldier, so how hard they're working mentally and if they are under stress.
Is the theory here that the single people that would be inside this dome, what is learned with them is transferable to large training exercises?
So the real benefit of having this dome is that when you study soldiers and you're really trying to get at some of these cognitive issues or to test particular pieces of technology and to get really good scientific data, you have to do it in a way where you can control much of the environment. And traditionally, this is done sort of in seated traditional psychology laboratories. So somebody might be sitting at a desk looking at a computer screen. In this doesn't give us the same realism as you might get with a soldier out in a field or doing a large-scale training exercise. But the problem is when you move right to those large-scale training exercises, you lose a lot of the control over what's happening in the environment, and it gets very hard to obtain sort of reliable data. And so by having something like this immersive dome capability, we're able to keep some of that really nice scientific control, but immerse soldiers in these operationally relevant environments. In the future, we're working on putting in other modalities of immersion, because the goal really is to have these soldiers feel like they are in this environment. And so these other modalities that will be in this dome in the future, within the next 2 years, are things like olfactory immersion. So if they are walking through a swampy area, they will actually smell the swamp. Within the visual modality, we have things like physics-based wind in the environment. So you can see the the blades of grass moving. You can see the leaves moving if it's stormy weather in the particular scenario. Within the next 2 years, we will also have a system that creates that physics-based wind on the participant as well as they're moving through. We're also including a vibrotactile immersion. So if the participant is moving, say, through a forest and they brush up against a tree, they will feel that pressure on their body.
And a final question, there's only one dome now. What do you envision? Can these domes be placed throughout the Army training throughout the world?
Yes, they could. In fact, at the moment, we're currently working with Tufts University with a joint center for applied brain and cognitive sciences, and we are creating a team-based virtual reality capability there in which we can use these domes. We will have three of these domes together, and we can use these domes either to look at individual behavior, or these domes can be linked together so that we can look at team behavior in a single environment. So that's the next step in this capability.
Dr. Carolyn Mahoney is team leader for the Cognitive Science and Applications team from the Army Natick Soldier Research, Development, and Engineering Center. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. A pleasure to speak with you.
You can read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.